Flattener number 5. Outsourcing Y2K. Until recently, India was what is known in the banking world as the second buyer. You always want to be the second buyer in business, the person who buys the hotel or the golf course or the shopping mall after the first owner has gone bankrupt and its assets are being sold by the bank at 10 cents on the dollar. Well, the first buyers of all the cable laid by all those fiber optic cable companies, which thought they were going to get endlessly rich in an endlessly expanding digital universe, were their American shareholders. When the bubble burst, they were left holding either worthless or much diminished stock. The Indians, in effect, got to be the second buyers of the fiber optics companies. They didn't actually purchase the shares. They just benefited from the overcapacity in fiber optics, which meant that they and their American clients got to use all that cable practically for free. This was a huge stroke of luck for India, and to a lesser degree for China, the former Soviet Union, and Eastern Europe. Because what is the history of modern India? In short, India is a country with virtually no natural resources that got very good at doing one thing: mining the brains of its own people by educating a relatively large slice of its elites in the sciences, engineering, and medicine. In 1951, to his enduring credit, Jawaharlal Nehru, India's first prime minister, set up the first of India's 7 Indian Institutes of Technology, IIT, in the eastern city of Kharagpur. In the 50 years since then, hundreds of thousands of Indians have competed to gain entry and then graduate from these IITs and their private sector equivalents. It's like a factory, churning out and exporting some of the most gifted engineering, computer science, and software talent on the globe. Because its often dysfunctional political system, coupled with Nehru's preference for pro-Soviet socialist economics, ensured that up until the mid-1990s, India could not provide good jobs for most of those talented engineers. So, America got to be the second buyer of India's brain power. If you were a smart, educated Indian, the only way you could fulfill your potential was by leaving the country and, ideally, going to America, where some 25,000 graduates of India's top engineering schools have settled since 1953, greatly enriching America's knowledge pool thanks to their education, which was subsidized by Indian taxpayers. And then, along came Netscape, the 1996 telecom deregulation, and Global Crossing and its fiber optic friends. The world got flattened, and that whole deal got turned on its head. India could never have afforded to pay for the bandwidth to connect brainy India with high-tech America, so American shareholders paid for it. It is fun to talk to Indians who were around at precisely the moment when American companies started to discover they could draw on India's brain power in India. One of them is Vivek Paul, now the president of Wipro, the Indian software giant. In many ways, the Indian information technology outsourcing revolution began with General Electric coming over. We're talking the late 1980s and early 90s. At the time, Texas Instruments was doing some chip design in India. Some of their key designers in America were Indians, and they basically let them go back home and work from there, using the rather crude communications networks that existed then to stay in touch. At that time, I was heading up the operations for GE Medical Systems in Bangalore. GE's chairman, Jack Welch, came to India in 1989 and was completely taken by India as a source of intellectual advantage for GE. Jack would say, "India is a developing country with a developed intellectual capability." He saw a talent pool that could be leveraged. So he said, "We spend a lot of money doing software. Couldn't we do some work for our IT department here?" Because India had closed its market to foreign technology companies like IBM, Indian companies had started their own factories to make PCs and servers, and Welch felt that if they could do it for themselves, they could do it for GE. GE decided to sink roots, starting a joint development project with Wipro. By the late 1990s, though, Lady Luck was starting to shine on India from two directions. The fiber optic bubble was starting to inflate, linking India with the United States, and the Y2K computer crisis, the so-called millennium bug, started gathering on the horizon. It meant that a huge number of existing computers, newer ones were being made with better clocks, needed to have their internal clocks and related systems adjusted. Otherwise, it was feared, they would shut down, creating a global crisis, given how many different management systems, from water to air traffic control, were computerized. This computer remediation work was a huge, tedious job. Who in the world had enough software engineers to do it all? Answer? India, with all the techies from all those IITs and private technical colleges and computer schools. And so, with Y2K bearing down on us, America and India started dating. And that relationship became a huge flattener because it demonstrated to so many different businesses that the combination of the PC, the internet, and fiber optic cable had created the possibility of a whole new form of collaboration and horizontal value creation. Outsourcing. Any service, call center, business support operation, or knowledge work that could be digitized could be sourced globally to the cheapest, smartest, or most efficient provider. Using fiber optic cable-connected workstations, Indian techies could get under the hood of your company's computers and do all the adjustments, even though they were located halfway around the world. By early 2000, the Y2K work started to wind down. But then a whole new driver of business emerged, e-commerce. The dot-com bubble had not yet burst, engineering talent was scarce, and demand from dot-coms was enormous. Outsourcing from America to India as a new form of collaboration exploded. India didn't benefit only from the dot-com boom, it benefited even more from the dot-com bust. That is the real irony. The boom laid the cable that connected India to the world, and the bust made the cost of using it virtually free, and also vastly increased the number of American companies that would want to use that fiber optic cable to outsource knowledge work to India. Y2K led to this mad rush for Indian brain power to get the programming work done. The Indian companies were good and cheap, but price wasn't first on customers' minds. Getting the work done was, and India was the only place with the volume of workers to do it. Then the dot-com boom comes along right in the wake of Y2K, and India is one of the few places where you can find surplus English-speaking engineers at any price, because all of those in America have been scooped up by e-commerce companies. Then the dot-com bubble bursts, the stock market tanks, and the pool of investment capital dries up. American IT companies that survived the boom and venture capital firms that still wanted to fund startups had much less cash to spend. Now they needed those Indian engineers not just because there were a lot of them, but precisely because they were low cost. So the relationship between India and the American business community intensified another notch. August 15th commemorates Freedom at Midnight. Y2K made possible employment at midnight, but not any employment. Employment for India's best knowledge workers. August 15th gave independence to India, but Y2K gave independence to Indians. Not all, by any stretch of the imagination, but a lot more than 50 years ago, and many of them from the most productive segment of the population. In that sense, yes, India was lucky, but it also reaped what it had sowed through hard work and education and the wisdom of its elders who built all those IITs. Louis Pasteur said it a long time ago, "Fortune favors the prepared mind." Flattener number 6, offshoring. Running with gazelles, eating with lions. On December 11, 2001, China formally joined the World Trade Organization, which meant Beijing agreed to follow the same global rules governing imports, exports, and foreign investments that most countries in the world were following. It meant China was agreeing, in principle, to make its own competitive playing field as level as the rest of the world. A few days later, the American-trained Chinese manager of a fuel pump factory in Beijing, which was owned by a friend of mine, Jack Perkowski, The chairman and CEO of Asimco Technologies, an American auto parts manufacturer in China, posted the following African proverb translated into Mandarin on his factory floor. Every morning in Africa, a gazelle wakes up. It knows it must run faster than the fastest lion or it will be killed. Every morning, a lion wakes up. It knows it must outrun the slowest gazelle or it will starve to death. It doesn't matter whether you are a lion or a gazelle. When the sun comes up, you better start running. I don't know who is the lion and who is the gazelle, but I do know this. Ever since the Chinese joined the WTO, both they and the rest of the world have had to run faster and faster. This is because China's joining the WTO gave a huge boost to another form of collaboration, offshoring. Offshoring, which has been around for decades, is different from outsourcing. Offshoring, by contrast, is when a company takes one of its factories that is operating in Canton, Ohio, and moves the whole factory offshore to Canton, China. There, it produces the very same product in the very same way, only with cheaper labor, lower taxes, subsidized energy, and lower healthcare costs. By joining the World Trade Organization in 2001, China assured foreign companies that if they shifted factories offshore to China, they would be protected by international law and standard business practices. This greatly enhanced China's attractiveness as a manufacturing platform. Under WTO rules, Beijing agreed, with some time for phase-in, to treat non-Chinese citizens or firms as if they were Chinese in terms of their economic rights and obligations under Chinese law. This meant that foreign companies could sell virtually anything anywhere in China. WTO membership status also meant that Beijing agreed to treat all WTO member nations equally, meaning that the same tariffs and the same regulations had to apply equally for everyone. And it agreed to submit itself to international arbitration in the event of a trade dispute with another country or a foreign company. At the same time, government bureaucrats became more customer-friendly. Procedures for investments were streamlined, and websites proliferated in different ministries to help foreigners navigate China's business regulations. Because China can amass so many low-wage workers at the unskilled, semi-skilled, and skilled levels, because it has such a voracious appetite for factory, equipment, and knowledge jobs to keep its people employed, and because it has such a massive and burgeoning consumer market, it has become an unparalleled zone for offshoring. China has more than 160 cities with a population of 1 million or more. You can go to towns on the east coast of China today that you have never heard of and discover that this one town manufactures most of the eyeglass frames in the world, while the town next door manufactures most of the portable cigarette lighters in the world. And the one next to that is doing most of the computer screens for Dell, and another is specializing in mobile phones. The more attractive China makes itself as a base for offshoring, the more attractive other developed and developing countries competing with it, like Malaysia, Thailand, Ireland, Mexico, Brazil, and Vietnam, have to make themselves. This has created a process of competitive flattening, in which countries scramble to see who can give companies the best tax breaks, education incentives, and subsidies on top of their cheap labor to encourage offshoring to their shores. China's real long-term strategy is to outrace America and the EU countries to the top, and the Chinese are off to a good start. China's leaders are much more focused than many of their Western counterparts on how to train their young people in the math, science, and computer skills required for success in the flat world, how to build a physical and telecom infrastructure that will allow Chinese people to plug and play faster and easier than others, and how to create incentives that will attract global investors. What China's leaders really want is the next generation of underwear or airplane wings to be designed in China as well. That is where things are heading in another decade. So in 30 years, we will have gone from sold in China to made in China to designed in China to dreamed up in China. Or from China as collaborator with the worldwide manufacturers on nothing to China as a low-cost, high-quality, hyper-efficient collaborator with worldwide manufacturers on everything. This should allow China to maintain its role as a major flattening force, provided that political instability does not disrupt the process. In an effort to better understand how offshoring to China works, I sat down in Beijing with Jack Perkowski of Asimco, a pioneer in this form of collaboration. When I first started back in 1992-1993, everyone thought the hard part was to actually find and gain access to opportunities in China, recalled Perkowski. As Perkowski put it, the easy part was setting up shop in China. The hard part was getting the right local managers who could run the store. We began looking for a new breed of Chinese managers who were open-minded and had gotten some form of management training. We were looking for individuals who were experienced at operating in China and yet were familiar with how the rest of the world operated and knew where China had to go. So between 1997 and 1999, we recruited a whole team of new China managers, typically mainland Chinese who had worked for multinationals, and as these managers came on board, we began one by one to replace the old China managers at our companies. Today, Asimco has sales of about $350 million a year in auto parts from 13 Chinese factories in 9 provinces. The company sells to customers in the United States, and it also has 36 sales offices throughout China servicing automakers in that country, too. From this base, Perkowski made his next big move, taking the profits from offshoring back onshore in America. In April of 2003, we bought the North American camshaft operations of Federal Mogul Corporation, an old-line components company that is now in bankruptcy, said Perkowski. We bought the business first to get access to its customers, which were primarily the big three automakers, plus Caterpillar and Cummins. While we have had long-standing relationships with Cat and Cummins, and this acquisition enhanced our position with them, the camshaft sales to the big three were our first. The second reason to make the acquisition was to obtain technology which we could bring back to China. Like most of the technology that goes into modern passenger cars and trucks, people take camshaft technology for granted. However, camshafts, the part of the engine that controls how the pistons go up and down, are highly engineered products which are critical to the performance of the engine. The acquisition of this business essentially gave us the know-how and technology that we could use to become the camshaft leader in China. As a result, we now have the best camshaft technology and a customer base both in China and the U.S. This is a very important point because the general impression is that offshoring is a lose-lose proposition for American workers, something that was here went over there, and that is the end of the story. The reality is more complicated. Most companies build offshore factories not simply to obtain cheaper labor for products they want to sell in America or Europe. Another motivation is to serve that foreign market without having to worry about trade barriers and to gain a dominant foothold there, particularly a giant market like China's. According to the U.S. Commerce Department, nearly 90% of the output from U.S.-owned offshore factories is sold to foreign consumers. But this actually stimulates American exports. There is a variety of studies indicating that every dollar a company invests overseas in an offshore factory yields additional exports for its home country, because roughly one-third of global trade today is within multinational companies. It works the other way as well. Even when production is moved offshore to save on wages, it is usually not all moved offshore. According to a January 26, 2004 study by the Heritage Foundation, Job Creation and the Taxation of Foreign Source Income, American companies that produce at home and abroad for both the American market and China's generate more than 21% of U.S. economic output, produce 56% of U.S. exports, and employ three-fifths of all manufacturing employees, about 9 million workers. So if General Motors builds a factory offshore in Shanghai, it also ends up creating jobs in America by exporting a lot of goods and services to its own factory in China and benefiting from lower parts costs in China for its factories in America. Finally, America is a beneficiary of the same phenomenon. While much attention is paid to American companies going offshore to China, little attention is paid to the huge amount of offshore investment coming into America every year, because foreigners want access to American markets and labor just like we want access to theirs. A CIMCO will use its new camshaft operation in China to handle the raw material and rough machining operations, exporting semi-finished products to its camshaft plant in America, where more skilled American workers can do the finished machining operations, which are most critical to quality. In this way, a CIMCO's American customers receive the benefit of a China supply chain and at the same time have the comfort of dealing with a known American supplier. The average wage of a high-skilled machinist in America is $3,000 to $4,000 a month. The average wage for a factory worker in China is about $150 a month. In addition, a CIMCO is required to participate in a Chinese government-sponsored pension plan covering healthcare, housing, and retirement benefits. Between 35 and 45% of a Chinese worker's monthly wage goes directly to the local labor bureau to cover these benefits. The fact that health insurance in China is so much cheaper, because of lower wages, much more limited health service offerings, and no malpractice suits, certainly makes China an attractive place to expand and add employees, explained Perkowski. Anything which can be done to reduce a U.S. company's liability for medical coverage would be a plus in keeping jobs in the U.S. By taking advantage of the flat world to collaborate this way, between onshore and offshore factories and between high-wage, high-skilled American workers close to their market and low-wage Chinese workers close to theirs, said Perkowski, we make our American company more competitive, so it is getting more orders and we are actually growing the business. And that is what many in the U.S. are missing when they talk about offshoring. The advantages for manufacturing in China for certain industries are becoming overwhelming, added Perkowski, and cannot be ignored. Either you get flat or you'll be flattened by China. If you are sitting in the U.S. and don't figure out how to get into China, he said, in 10 or 15 years from now, you will not be a global leader. Flattener number 7. Supply chaining. Eating sushi in Arkansas. I had never seen what a supply chain looked like in action until I visited Walmart headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas. My Walmart hosts took me over to the 1.2 million square foot distribution center where we climbed up to a viewing perch and watched the show. On one side of the building, scores of white Walmart trailer trucks were dropping off boxes of merchandise from thousands of different suppliers. Boxes large and small were fed up a conveyor belt at each loading dock. These little conveyor belts fed into a bigger belt, like streams feeding into a powerful river. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the suppliers' trucks feed the 12 miles of conveyor streams, and the conveyor streams feed into a huge Walmart river of boxed products. But that is just half the show. As the Walmart River flows along, an electric eye reads the barcodes on each box on its way to the other side of the building. There, the river parts again into 100 streams. Electric arms from each stream reach out and guide the boxes, ordered by particular Walmart stores, off the main river and down its stream, where another conveyor belt sweeps them into a waiting Walmart truck, which will rush these particular products onto the shelves of a particular Walmart store somewhere in the country. There, a consumer will lift one of these products off the shelf, and the cashier will scan it in, and the moment that happens, a signal will be generated. That signal will go out across the Walmart network to the supplier of that product, whether that supplier's factory is in coastal China or coastal Maine. That signal will pop up on the supplier's computer screen and prompt him to make another of that item and ship it via the Walmart supply chain, and the whole cycle will start anew. Walmart's ability to bring off this symphony on a global scale, moving 2.3 billion general merchandise cartons a year down its supply chain into its stores, has made it the most important example of the next great flattener I want to discuss, which I call supply chaining. Supply chaining is a method of collaborating horizontally among suppliers, retailers, and customers to create value. Supply chaining is both enabled by the flattening of the world and a hugely important flattener itself, because the more these supply chains grow and proliferate, the more they force the adoption of common standards between companies so that every link of every supply chain can interface with the next. The more they eliminate points of friction at borders, the more the efficiencies of one company get adopted by others, and the more they encourage global collaboration. As consumers, we love supply chains because they deliver us all sorts of goods, from tennis shoes to laptop computers, at lower and lower prices. That is how Walmart became the world's biggest retailer. But as workers, we are sometimes ambivalent or hostile to these supply chains because they expose us to higher and higher pressures to compete, cut costs, and also, at times, cut wages and benefits. That is how Walmart became one of the world's most controversial companies. In pursuit of the world's most efficient supply chain, Walmart has piled up a list of business offenses over the years that has given the company several deserved black eyes and that it is belatedly starting to address in a meaningful way. But its role as one of the 10 forces that flattened the world is undeniable, and it was to get a handle on this that I decided to make my own pilgrimage to Bentonville. I don't know why, but on the flight in from LaGuardia, I was thinking, boy, I would really like some sushi tonight. But where am I going to find sushi in Northwest Arkansas? When I arrived at the Hilton near Walmart's headquarters, I was stunned to see, like a mirage, a huge Japanese steakhouse sushi restaurant right next door. The demand for sushi in Arkansas is not an accident. It has to do with the fact that all around Walmart's offices, vendors have set up their own operations to be close to the mothership. Indeed, the area is known as Vendorville. The amazing thing about Walmart's headquarters is that it is so, well, Walmart. The corporate offices are crammed into a reconfigured warehouse. The company is definitely not wasting your money on frills. Walmart became the biggest retailer in the world because it drove a hard bargain with everyone it came in contact with. But make no mistake about one thing. Walmart also became number one because this little hick company from Northwest Arkansas was smarter and faster about adopting new technology than any of its competitors, and it still is. David Glass, the company's CEO from 1988 to 2000, oversaw many of the innovations that made Walmart the biggest and most profitable retailer on the planet. When Walmart was just getting started in northern Arkansas in the 1960s, explained Glass, it wanted to be a discounter. But in those days, every five and dime got its goods from the same wholesalers, so there was no way to get an edge on your competitors. The only way Walmart could see to get an edge, he said, was for it to buy its goods in volume directly from the manufacturers. But it wasn't efficient for manufacturers to ship to multiple Walmart stores spread all over, so Walmart set up a distribution center to which all the manufacturers could ship their merchandise. And then Walmart got its own trucks to distribute these goods itself to its stores. Walmart focused relentlessly on three things. The first was working with the manufacturers to get them to cut their costs as much as possible. The second was working on its supply chain from those manufacturers, wherever they were in the world, to Walmart's distribution centers to make it as low cost and frictionless as possible. The third was constantly improving Walmart's information systems so it knew exactly what its customers were buying and could feed that information to all the manufacturers so the shelves would always be stocked with the right items at the right time. Walmart quickly realized that if it could save money by buying directly from the manufacturers, by constantly innovating to cut the cost of running its supply chain, and by keeping its inventories low by learning more about its customers, it could beat its competitors on price every time. Sitting in Bentonville, Arkansas, it didn't have much choice. The more that supply chain grew, the more Walton and Glass understood that scale and efficiency were the keys to their whole business. Put simply, the more scale and scope their supply chain had, the more things they sold for less to more customers, the more leverage they had with suppliers to drive prices down even more, the more they sold to more customers, the more scale and scope their supply chain had, the more profit they reaped for their shareholders. Sam Walton was the father of that culture, but necessity was its mother, and its offspring has turned out to be a lean, mean supply chain machine. In 2004, Walmart purchased roughly $260 billion worth of merchandise and ran it through a supply chain consisting of 108 distribution centers around the United States, serving the some 3,000 Walmart stores in America. In improving its supply chain, Walmart leaves no link untouched. In 1983, Walmart invested in point-of-sale terminals, which simultaneously rang up sales and tracked inventory deductions for rapid resupply. 4 years later, it installed a large-scale satellite system linking all of the stores to company headquarters, giving Walmart's central computer system real-time inventory data and paving the way for a supply chain greased by information and humming down to the last atom of efficiency. Now Walmart, in its latest supply chain innovation, has introduced RFID, radio frequency identification microchips, attached to each pallet and merchandise box that comes into Walmart, to replace barcodes, which have to be scanned individually and can get ripped or soiled. In June 2003, Walmart informed its top 100 suppliers that by January 1, 2005, all pallets and boxes that they ship to Walmart distribution centers have to come equipped with RFID tags. RFID will allow Walmart to track any pallet or box at each stage in its supply chain and know exactly what product from which manufacturer is inside with what expiration date. If a grocery item has to be stored at a certain temperature, the RFID tag will tell Walmart when the temperature is too high or too low. Because each of these tags costs around 20 cents, Walmart is reserving them now for big boxes and pallets, not individual items. But this is clearly the wave of the future. Unfortunately for Walmart, the same factors that drove its instinct for constant innovation, its isolation from the world, its need to dig inside itself, and its need to connect remote locations to a global supply chain, also got it in trouble. I am talking about everything from Walmart's recently exposed practice of locking overnight workers into its stores to its allowing Walmart's maintenance contractors to use illegal immigrants as janitors, to its role as defendant in the largest civil rights class action lawsuit in history, to its refusal to stock certain magazines, like Playboy, on its shelves, even in small towns where Walmart is the only major store. This is all aside from the fact that some of Walmart's biggest competitors complain that they have had to cut healthcare benefits and create a lower wage tier to compete with Walmart, which pays less and covers less than most big companies. But when I asked Walmart's CEO, H. Lee Scott Jr., directly about all these issues, he did not duck. In fact, he wanted to talk about it. What I think I have to do is institutionalize this sense of obligation to society to the same extent that we have institutionalized the commitment to the customer, said Scott. The world has changed, and we have missed that. We believed that good intentions and good stores and good prices would cause people to forgive what we are not as good at, and we were wrong. In certain areas, he added, we are not as good as we should be. Just have to get better. One trend that Walmart insists it is not responsible for is the offshoring of manufacturing. "We are much better off if we can buy merchandise made in the United States," said Glass. "I spent 2 years going around this country trying to talk people into manufacturing here. We would pay more to buy it here because the manufacturing facilities in those towns would create jobs for all those people who shopped in our stores. But for the most part, people in this country have just abandoned the manufacturing process. They say, 'I want to sell to you, but I don't want the responsibility for the buildings and the employees and healthcare. I want to source it somewhere else.'" So we were forced to source merchandise in other places in the world. He added, "One of my concerns is that, with the manufacturing out of this country, one day we'll all be selling hamburgers to each other." Flattener number 8. Insourcing. What the guys in funny brown shorts are really doing. One of the most enjoyable things about researching this book has been discovering all sorts of things happening in the world around me of which I had no clue. Nothing was more surprisingly interesting than pulling the curtain back on UPS, United Parcel Service. Yes, those folks, the ones who wear the homely brown shorts and drive those ugly brown trucks. Turns out that while I was sleeping, stodgy old UPS became a huge force flattening the world. Nandan Nilekani, the Infosys CEO, who tipped me off to this. FedEx and UPS should be one of your flatteners. They're not just delivering packages, they are doing logistics, he told me on the phone from Bangalore one day. UPS, I learned, was not just delivering packages anymore, it was synchronizing global supply chains for companies large and small. UPS still pulls in most of its $36 billion in sales by shipping more than 13.5 million packages a day from point A to point B. But behind that innocuous facade, the company founded in Seattle in 1907 as a messenger service has reinvented itself as a dynamic supply chain manager. Consider this. If you own a Toshiba laptop computer that is under warranty and it breaks and you call Toshiba to have it repaired, Toshiba will tell you to drop it off at a UPS store and have it shipped to Toshiba, and it will get repaired and then be shipped back to you. But here's what they don't tell you. UPS doesn't just pick up and deliver your Toshiba laptop. UPS actually repairs the computer in its own UPS-run workshop dedicated to computer and printer repairs at its Louisville hub. I went to tour that hub, expecting to see only packages moving around, and instead, I found myself dressed in a blue smock in a special clean room, watching UPS employees replacing motherboards in broken Toshiba laptops. Toshiba had developed an image problem several years ago, with some customers concluding that its repair process for broken machines took too long. So Toshiba came to UPS and asked it to design a better system. It is now possible to send your Toshiba laptop in one day, get it repaired the next, and have it back the third day. The UPS repair men and women were all certified by Toshiba, and its customer complaints went down dramatically. What is going on here? It's a process that has come to be called insourcing, a whole new form of collaboration and creating value horizontally, made possible by the flat world and flattening it even more. Insourcing came about because once the world went flat, the small could act big. Small companies could suddenly see around the world. Once they did, they saw a lot of places where they could sell their goods, manufacture their goods, or buy their raw materials in a more efficient manner. But many of them either didn't know how to pull all this off or couldn't afford to manage a complex global supply chain on their own. This created a whole new global business opportunity for traditional package delivery firms like UPS. In 1996, UPS went into the business of synchronized commerce solutions. It has spent $1 billion since then to buy 25 different global logistics and freight forwarding firms so that it could service virtually any supply chain from one corner of the flat earth to the other. The business took off right around 2000. I like the term insourcing because UPS engineers come right inside your company, analyze its manufacturing, packaging and delivery processes, and then design, redesign, and manage your whole global supply chain. And if necessary, they'll even finance parts of it, such as receivables and COD payments. There are companies today, many of them don't want their names mentioned, that never touch their own products anymore. You know who the majority of our customers and partners are? Small businesses, said UPS Chairman and CEO Mike Eskew. That's right. They are asking us to take them global. We help these companies achieve parity with the bigger guys. Indeed, when you are a small business or individual working at home and you can plug into UPS and have it become your global supply chain manager, you can pretend you are a lot bigger than you are. UPS bought Mailboxes, etc., now the UPS store in the United States, so that it could offer individuals and small businesses the power of its global supply chain services. But UPS also helps the big to act small. When you are a huge conglomerate like HP, and you can get packages delivered or goods repaired quickly anywhere in the world, you can act really small. In addition, by making the delivery of goods and services around the world super efficient and super fast and in huge volumes, UPS is helping to level customs barriers and harmonize trade by getting more and more people to adopt the same rules and labels and tracking systems for transporting goods. UPS has a smart label on all its packages so that package can be tracked and traced anywhere in its network. UPS maintains a think tank, the Operations Research Division, in Timonium, Maryland, which works on supply chain algorithms. This school of mathematics is called Package Flow Technology, and it is designed to constantly match the deployment of UPS trucks, ships, airplanes, and sorting capabilities with that day's flow of packages around the world. UPS also employs its own meteorologists and strategic threat analysts to track which atmospheric or geopolitical thunderstorms it will have to work around on any given day. To further grease its supply chains, UPS is the largest private user of wireless technology in the world, as its drivers alone make over 1 million phone calls a day in the process of picking up and delivering packages through its 88,000 package cars, vans, tractors, and motorcycles. On any given day, according to UPS, 2% of the world's GDP can be found in UPS delivery trucks or package cars. Oh, and did I mention that UPS also has a financing arm? UPS Capital, that will put up the money for the transformation of your supply chain, particularly if you are a small business and don't have the capital. As consumers have become more empowered to pull their own products via the internet and customize them for themselves, UPS has found itself in the interesting position of being not only the company actually taking the orders, but also as the delivery service, the one handing the goods to the buyer at the front door. As a result, companies said, "Let's try to push as many differentiating things to the end of the supply chain rather than the beginning." And because UPS was the last link in the supply chain before these goods were loaded onto planes, trains, and trucks, it took over many of these functions, creating a whole new business called End of Runway Services. The day I visited Louisville, two young UPS women were putting together Nikon cameras with special memory cards and leather cases, which some store had offered as a weekend special. They were even putting them in special boxes just for that store. By taking over this function, UPS gives companies more options to customize products at the last minute. Insourcing is distinct from supply chaining because it goes well beyond supply chain management. Because it is third-party managed logistics, it requires a much more intimate and extensive kind of collaboration among UPS and its clients' clients. In many cases today, UPS and its employees are so deep inside their clients' infrastructure that it is almost impossible to determine where one stops and the other starts. The UPS people are not just synchronizing your packages. They are synchronizing your whole company and its interaction with both customers and suppliers. This is no longer a vendor-customer relationship, said Eskew. We answer your phones, we talk to your customers, we house your inventory, and we tell you what sells and doesn't sell. We have access to your information, and you have to trust us. We manage competitors, and the only way for this to work, as our founders told Gimbel's and Macy's, is trust us. I won't violate that. Because we are asking people to let go of part of their business, and that really requires trust. UPS is creating enabling platforms for anyone to take his or her business global or to vastly improve the efficiency of his or her global supply chain. It is a totally new business, but UPS is convinced it has an almost limitless upside. Time will tell. Though margins are still thin in this kind of work, in 2003 alone, insourcing pulled in $2.4 billion in revenues for UPS. My gut tells me the folks in the funny brown shorts and funny brown trucks are onto something big, something made possible only by the flattening of the world, and something that is going to flatten it a lot more. Flattener number 9. Informing. Google, Yahoo, MSN Web Search. Google headquarters in Mountain View, California, has a certain Epcot Center feel to it. So many fun space-age toys to play with, so little time. In one corner is a spinning globe that emits light beams based on the volume of people searching on Google. As you would expect, most of the shafts of light are shooting up from North America, Europe, Korea, Japan, and coastal China. The Middle East and Africa remain pretty dark. In another corner is a screen that shows a sample of what things people are searching for at that moment, all over the world. When I was there in 2001, I asked my hosts what had been the most frequent searches lately. One, of course, was sex, a perennial favorite of Googlers. Another was God, lots of people searching for him or her. A third was jobs. You can't find enough of those. And the fourth most searched item around the time of my visit? I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. Professional wrestling. Fortunately, no single word or subject accounts for more than 1 or 2% of all Google searches at any given time, so no one should get too worried about the fate of humanity on the basis of Google's top search items on any particular day. Indeed, it is the remarkable diversity of searches going on via Google in so many different tongues that makes the Google search engine, and search engines in general, such huge flatteners. Never before in the history of the planet have so many people, on their own, had the ability to find so much information about so many things and so many other people. That is certainly Google's goal. To make easily available all the world's knowledge in every language. And Google hopes that in time, with a Palm Pilot or a cell phone, everyone everywhere will be able to carry around access to all the world's knowledge in their pockets. There is no bigger flattener than the idea of making all the world's knowledge, or even just a big chunk of it, available to anyone and everyone, anytime, anywhere. We do discriminate only to the degree that if you can't use a computer or don't have access to one, you can't use Google. But other than that, if you can type, you can use Google, said Google CEO Eric Schmidt. And surely if the flattening of the world means anything, he added, it means that there is no discrimination in accessing knowledge. Google is now searchable in 100 languages, and every time we find another, we increase it. Let's imagine a group with a Google iPod one day, and you can tell it to search by voice. That would take care of people who can't use a computer. And then, Google access just becomes about the rate at which we can get cheap devices into people's hands. How does searching fit into the concept of collaboration? I call it informing. Informing is the individual's personal analog to open sourcing, outsourcing, insourcing, supply chaining, and offshoring. Informing is the ability to build and deploy your own personal supply chain, a supply chain of information, knowledge, and entertainment. Informing is about self-collaboration, becoming your own self-directed and self-empowered researcher, editor, and selector of entertainment. without having to go to the library or the movie theater or through network television. Informing is searching for knowledge. It is about seeking like-minded people and communities. Google's phenomenal global popularity, which has spurred Yahoo and Microsoft through its new MSN search, also to make power searching and informing prominent features of their websites, shows how hungry people are for this form of collaboration. Google is now processing roughly 1 billion searches per day, up from 150 million just 3 years ago. The easier and more accurate searching becomes, added Larry Page, Google's other co-founder, the more global Google's user base becomes, and the more powerful a flattener it becomes. Every day, more and more people are able to inform themselves in their own language. Today, said Page, only a third of our searches are U.S.-based, and less than half are in English. Moreover, he added, as people are searching for more obscure things, people are publishing more obscure things, which drives the flattening effect of informing even more. Brin and Page, who met as Stanford University graduate students in computer science in 1995, developed a mathematical formula that ranked a web page by how many other web pages were linked to it, on the assumption that the more people linked to a certain page, the more important the page. The key breakthrough that enabled Google to become first among search engines was its ability to combine its PageRank technology with an analysis of page content, which determines which pages are most relevant to the specific search being conducted. Even though Google entered the market after other major search players, its answers were seen by people as more accurate and relevant to what they were looking for. The fact that one search engine was just a little better than the others led a tidal wave of people to switch to it. For some reason, said Brin, people underestimated the importance of finding information, as opposed to other things you would do online. If you are searching for something like a health issue, you really want to know. In some cases, it is a life and death matter. We have people who search Google for heart attack symptoms and then call 911. Companies like Google, Yahoo, Amazon.com, and TiVo have learned to thrive not by pushing products and services on their customers as much as by building collaborative systems that enable customers to pull on their own and then responding with lightning quickness to what they pull. It is so much more efficient. Search is so highly personal that searching is empowering for humans like nothing else, said Google CEO Eric Schmidt. It is the antithesis of being told or taught. It is about self-empowerment. It is empowering individuals to do what they think best with the information they want. It is very different from anything else that preceded it. Radio was one to many. TV was one to many. The telephone was one to one. Search is the ultimate expression of the power of the individual using a computer, looking at the world, and finding exactly what they want. And everyone is different when it comes to that. Of course, what made Google not just a search engine, but a hugely profitable business, was its founders' realization that they could build a targeted advertising model that would show you ads that are relevant to you when you searched for a specific topic, and then could charge advertisers for the number of times Google users clicked on their ads. Whereas CBS broadcasts a movie and has a less exact idea who is watching it or the advertisements, Google knows exactly what you are interested in. After all, you are searching for it and can link you up with advertisers directly or indirectly connected to your searches. In late 2004, Google began a service whereby if you are walking around Bethesda, Maryland, and are in the mood for sushi, you just send Google an SMS message on your phone that says, Sushi 20817, the Bethesda zip code, and it will send you back a text message of choices. Lord only knows where this will go. Informing, though, also involves searching for friends, allies, and collaborators. It is empowering the formation of global communities across all international and cultural boundaries, which is another critically important flattening function. People can now search out fellow collaborators on any subject, project, or theme, particularly through portals like Yahoo Groups. Yahoo has about 300 million users and 4 million active groups. Those groups have 13 million unique individuals accessing them each month from all over the world. There is another side to informing that people are going to have to get used to, and that is other people's ability to inform themselves about you from a very early age. Search engines flatten the world by eliminating all the valleys and peaks, all the walls and rocks that people used to hide inside of, atop, behind, or under in order to mask their reputations or parts of their past. In a flat world, you can't run, you can't hide, and smaller rocks are turned over. Live your life honestly, because whatever you do, whatever mistakes you make, will be searchable one day. The flatter the world becomes, the more ordinary people become transparent and available. Before my daughter Orly went off to college in the fall of 2003, she was telling me about some of her roommates. When I asked her how she knew some of the things she knew, had she spoken to them or received an email from them, she told me she had done neither. She just Googled them. She came up with stuff from high school newspapers, local papers, etc., and fortunately no police records. These are high school kids. In the age of the superpower search, everyone is a celebrity. Google levels information. It has no class boundaries or education boundaries. If I can operate Google, I can find anything, said Alan Cohen, vice president of Airspace, which sells wireless technology. Google is like God. God is wireless. God is everywhere, and God sees everything. Any questions in the world? You ask Google. Some months after Cohen made that observation to me, I came across the following brief business story on CNETNews.com. Search giant Google said on Wednesday that it has acquired Keyhole, a company specializing in web-based software that allows people to view satellite images from around the globe. The software gives users the ability to zoom in from space level. In some cases, it can zoom in all the way to a street-level view. The company does not have high-resolution imagery for the entire globe, but its website offers a list of cities that are available for a more detailed viewing. The company has focused most on covering large metropolitan areas in the United States and is working to expand its coverage. Flattener number 10. The steroids. Digital, mobile, personal, and virtual. I am on the bullet train speeding southwest from Tokyo to Mishima. The view is spectacular. Fishing villages on my left and a snow-dusted Mount Fuji on my right. My colleague Jim Brook, the Tokyo bureau chief for the New York Times, is sitting across the aisle and paying no attention to the view. He is engrossed in his computer. So am I, actually, but he's online through a wireless connection, and I'm just typing away on a column on my unconnected laptop. Ever since we took a cab together the other day in downtown Tokyo, and Jim whipped out his wireless-enabled laptop in the back seat and emailed me something through Yahoo, I have been exclaiming at the amazing degree of wireless penetration and connectivity in Japan. Save for a few remote islands and mountain villages, if you have a wireless card in your computer or any Japanese cell phone, you can get online anywhere, from deep inside the subway stations to the bullet trains speeding through the countryside. Jim knows I am slightly obsessed with the fact that Japan, not to mention most of the rest of the world, has so much better wireless connectivity than America. Anyway, Jim likes to rub it in. I know that America will catch up sooner or later with the rest of the world in wireless technology. It's already happening. But this section about the 10th flattener is not just about wireless. It is about what I call the steroids. I call certain new technologies the steroids because they are amplifying and turbocharging all the other flatteners. They are taking all the forms of collaboration highlighted in this section, outsourcing, offshoring, open sourcing, supply chaining, insourcing, and informing, and making it possible to do each and every one of them in a way that is digital, mobile, virtual, and personal. As former HP CEO Carly Fiorina put it in her speeches, thereby enhancing each one and making the world flatter by the day. What does the flat world look like when you take all these new forms of collaboration and turbocharge them in this way? Let me give you just one example. Bill Brody, the president of Johns Hopkins, told me this story in the summer of 2004. I am sitting in a medical meeting in Vail, and the doctor giving a lecture quotes a study from Johns Hopkins University. And the guy speaking is touting a new approach to treating prostate cancer that went against the grain of the current surgical method. It was a minimally invasive approach to prostate cancer. So he quotes a study by Dr. Patrick Walsh, who had developed the state-of-the-art standard of care for prostate surgery. This guy who is speaking proposes an alternate method, which was controversial, but he quotes from Walsh's Hopkins study in a way that supported his approach. When he said that, I said to myself, that doesn't sound like Dr. Walsh's study. So I had a PDA, personal digital assistant, and I immediately went online wirelessly and got into the Johns Hopkins portal and into Medline and did a search right while I was sitting there. Up come all the Walsh abstracts. I toggled on one and read it, and it was not at all what the guy was saying it was. So I raised my hand during the Q&A and read two lines from the abstract, and the guy just turned beet red. The digitization and storage of all the Johns Hopkins faculty research in recent years made it possible for Brody to search it instantly and virtually without giving it a second thought. The advances in wireless technology made it possible for him to do that search from anywhere with any device. And his handheld personal computer enabled him to do that search personally, by himself, just for himself. What are the steroids that made all this possible? One simple way to think about computing at any scale is that it is comprised of three things: computational capability, storage capability, and input-output capability. The speed by which information is drawn in and out of the computer/storage complexes. And all of these have been steadily increasing since the days of the first bulky mainframes. This mutually reinforcing progress constitutes a significant steroid. For instance, MIPS stands for millions of instructions per second, and it is one measure of the computational capability of a computer's microchips. In 1971, the Intel 4004 microprocessor produced 0.06 MIPS, or 60,000 instructions per second. Today's Intel Pentium 4 Extreme Edition has a theoretical maximum of 10.8 billion instructions per second. Meanwhile, inputting and outputting data have leaped ahead at a staggering rate, at the speeds that disk drives operated back in the early days of 286 and 386 chips. It would have taken about a minute to download a single photo from my latest digital camera. Today I can do that in less than a second on a USB 2.0 disk drive and a Pentium processor. 5 years ago, no one would have believed that you would be able to sell iPods with 40 gigabytes of storage, capable of holding thousands of songs, for prices that teenagers could afford. Now it's seen as ho-hum. And when it comes to moving all these bits around, the computing world has been turbocharged. Advances in fiber optics will soon allow a single fiber to carry 1 terabit per second. With 48 fibers in a cable, that's 48 terabits per second. Then add another hardware steroid to the mix: file sharing. It started with Napster, paving the way for two of us to share songs stored on each other's computers. Free music that you could obtain nearly effortlessly from a gigantic database. That database was actually a file-sharing architecture by which Napster facilitated a connection between my computer and yours so that we could swap music files. The original Napster is dead, but file-sharing technology is still around and is getting more sophisticated every day, greatly enhancing collaboration. Finally, add one last hardware steroid that brings these technology breakthroughs together for consumers: the steady breakthrough in multi-purpose devices, ever smaller and more powerful laptops, cell phones, and handheld personal organizers that can keep your appointments, make calls, send email, take pictures, and even serve as video cameras. Collaborating with all this digitized data is going to be made even easier and cheaper thanks to another burgeoning steroid: Voice over Internet Protocol Service, known as VoIP. VoIP allows you to make phone calls over the internet by turning voices into data packets that are sent down internet networks and converted back into voices on the other end. VoIP allows anyone who subscribes to the service through his phone company or private operator to receive unlimited local and long-distance phone calls via the internet over his personal computer, laptop, or PDA with just a small microphone attachment. It is personal, and it will be delivered virtually. The underlying pipes will make it happen without your having to think about it at all. It will make every business and personal phone call to anywhere in the world as cheap as a local call. That is, almost free. And if that won't amplify every form of collaboration, I don't know what will. There is another steroid related to VoIP which will turbocharge this turbocharger: the breakthrough improvements in video conferencing. HP and the film company DreamWorks SKG collaborated on the design of a video conferencing suite, with DreamWorks bringing its movie and sound expertise and HP contributing its computing and compression technology that is breathtaking. Each party to the video conference sits at a long table facing a wall of flat panel TV screens and cameras pointed at them. The flat panel screens display the people at the other site, which could be anywhere in the world. It creates an effect of everyone sitting around a single conference table and is apparently a qualitatively different experience from anything that has been on the market before. I had a chance to participate in a demonstration of it, and it was so realistic that you could practically feel the breath of the other parties to the video conference, when in fact half of us were in Santa Barbara and half were 500 miles away. Because DreamWorks is doing film and animation work all over the world, it felt that it had to have a video conferencing solution where its creative people could really communicate all their thoughts, facial expressions, feelings, ire, enthusiasm, and raised eyebrows. HP's chief strategy and technology officer, Shane Robison, told me that HP plans to have these video conferencing suites for sale by 2005 at a cost of roughly $250,000 each. That is nothing compared to the airline tickets and wear and tear on executives having to travel regularly to London or Tokyo for face-to-face meetings. Companies could easily make one of these suites pay for itself in a year. This level of video conferencing, once it proliferates, will make remote development, outsourcing, and offshoring that much easier and more efficient. And now the icing on the cake, the Uber steroid that makes it all mobile, wireless. Wireless is what will allow you to take everything that has been digitized, made virtual and personal, and do it from anywhere. The natural state of communications is wireless, argued Alan Cohen, the senior vice president at Airspace. It started with voice because people wanted to be able to make a phone call anytime from any place to anywhere. That is why, for many people, the cell phone is the most important phone they own. By the early 21st century, people began to develop that same expectation, and with it, the desire for data communication. The ability to access the internet, email, or any business files anytime, anywhere using a cell phone, Palm Pilot, or some other personal device. In the early days of computing, you worked in the office. There was a big mainframe computer, and you literally had to walk over and get the people running the mainframe to extract or input information for you. It was like an oracle. Then, thanks to the PC and the internet, email, the laptop, the browser, and the client server, I could access from my own screen all sorts of data and information being stored on the network. In this era, you were de-linked from the office and could work at home, at the beach house, or in a hotel, where, thanks to digitization, miniaturization, virtualization, personalization, and wireless, I can be processing, collecting, or transmitting voice or data from anywhere to anywhere, as an individual or as a machine. Right now, consumers are caught in a maze of wireless technology offerings and standards that are still not totally interoperable. As we all know, some wireless technology works in one neighborhood, state, or country, and not in another. The Mobile Me revolution will be complete when you can move seamlessly around the town, the country, or the world with whatever device you want. The technology is getting there. When this is fully diffused, the Mobile Me will have its full flattening effect by freeing people to truly be able to work and communicate from anywhere to anywhere with anything. These steroids should make open source innovation that much more open, because they will enable more individuals to collaborate with one another in more ways and from more places than ever before. They will enhance outsourcing because they will make it so much easier for a single department of any company to collaborate with another company. They will enhance supply chaining because headquarters will be able to be connected in real time with every individual employee stocking the shelves, every individual package, and every Chinese factory manufacturing the stuff inside them. They will enhance insourcing, having a company like UPS come deep inside a retailer and manage its whole supply chain using drivers who can interact with its warehouses and with every customer carrying his own PDA. And most obviously, they will enhance informing, the ability to manage your own knowledge supply chain. Can you hear me now? The Triple Convergence. What is the Triple Convergence? The short answer is this. First, right around the year 2000, all 10 of the flatteners discussed in the previous chapter started to converge and work together in ways that created a new, flatter global playing field. As this new playing field became established, both businesses and individuals began to adopt new habits, skills, and processes to get the most out of it. They moved from largely vertical means of creating value to more horizontal ones. The merger of this new playing field for doing business with the new ways of doing business was the second convergence, and it actually helped to flatten the world even further. Finally, just when all of this flattening was happening, a whole new group of people, several billion in fact, walked out onto the playing field from China, India, and the former Soviet Empire. Thanks to the new flat world and its new tools, some of them were quickly able to collaborate and compete directly with everyone else. This was the third convergence. Now let's look at each in detail. Convergence 1. All 10 flatteners discussed in the previous chapter have been around, we know, since the 1990s, if not earlier. But they had to spread and take root and connect with one another to work their magic on the world. For instance, at some point around 2003, Southwest Airlines realized that there were enough PCs around, enough bandwidth, enough computer storage, enough internet-comfortable customers, and enough software know-how for Southwest to create a workflow system that empowered its customers to download and print out their own boarding passes at home as easily as downloading a piece of email. Southwest could collaborate with its customers, and they with Southwest, in a new way. And somewhere around the same time, the workflow software and hardware converged in a way that enabled Konica Minolta to offer scanning, emailing, printing, faxing, and copying all from the same machine. This is the first convergence. It is my contention that the opening of the Berlin Wall, Netscape, workflow, outsourcing, offshoring, open sourcing, insourcing, supply chaining, informing, and the steroids, amplifying them all, reinforced one another, like complementary goods. They just needed time to converge and start to work together in a complementary, mutually enhancing fashion. That tipping point arrived somewhere around the year 2000. The net result of this convergence was the creation of a global, web-enabled playing field that allows for multiple forms of collaboration, the sharing of knowledge and work in real time, without regard to geography, distance, or, in the near future, even language. No, not everyone has access yet to this platform, this playing field, but it is open today to more people in more places on more days in more ways than anything like it ever before in the history of the world. This is what I mean when I say the world has been flattened. It is the complementary convergence of the 10 flatteners creating this new global playing field for multiple forms of collaboration. Convergence 2. Great, you say, but why is it only in the past few years that we started to see in the United States the big surges in productivity that should be associated with such a technological leap? Answer? Because it always takes time for all the flanking technologies and the business processes and habits needed to get the most out of them to converge and create that next productivity breakthrough. Introducing new technology alone is never enough. The big spurts in productivity come when a new technology is combined with new ways of doing business. Walmart got big productivity boosts when it combined big box stores, where people could buy soap supplies for 6 months, with new horizontal supply chain management systems that allowed Walmart instantly to connect what a customer took off the shelf from a Walmart in Kansas City with what a Walmart supplier in coastal China could produce. The same thing is happening today with the flattening of the world. Many of the 10 flatteners have been around for years. But for the full flattening effects to be felt, we needed not only the 10 flatteners to converge, but also something else. We needed the emergence of a large cadre of managers, innovators, business consultants, business schools, designers, IT specialists, CEOs, and workers to get comfortable with and develop the sorts of horizontal collaboration and value creation processes and habits that could take advantage of this new, flatter playing field. In short, the convergence of the 10 flatteners begat the convergence of a set of business practices and skills that would get the most out of the flat world. And then the two began to mutually reinforce each other. Consider the example of WPP, the second largest advertising marketing communications consortium in the world. WPP, which is based in England, did not exist as we now know it 20 years ago. It is a product of the consolidation of some of the biggest names in the business, from Young and Rubicam to Ogilvy and Mather to Hill and Knowlton. The alliance was put together to capture more and more of big clients' marketing needs, such as advertising, direct mail, media buying, and branding. For years, the big challenge for WPP was how to get its own companies to collaborate, said Alan Adamson, managing director of WPP's branding firm, Landor Associates. Now, though, it is often no longer enough just to get the companies in WPP to work together per se. Increasingly, we find ourselves pulling together individuals from within each of these companies to form a customized collaborative team for just one client. The solution that will create value for that client did not exist in any one company or even in the traditional integration of the companies. It had to be much more specifically tailored. So we had to go down inside the whole group and pluck the individual who is the right ad person to work with the right branding person to work with the right media person for this particular client.